Thank you very much, brother. Very, very good. Very interesting, and appreciate all of what you had to say. A few months ago, one of the independent Christian churches here in town was having a conference, and they advertised this conference as they were going to discuss how to restore or how to promote restoration ideals today, and how can we revise the restoration movement in America today. And when I got there, the first thing that they did in that conference was they taught the audience a little jingle, a little tune. And in the tune were a few restoration slogans kind of strung together with music. And this was the last slogan in all things, in matters of doctrine, in matters of faith, unity, in matters of opinion, liberty, and all things charity. That was the end of the jingle. So it's very much alive today, certainly in the Christian churches. And we see, and now I understand a lot more about the slogan and its history. So I appreciate that.
A few years ago, you know, the disciples divided and the conservative element pulled away for some reasons. And they operate the college down in Joplin, the Ozark, used to be Ozark Bible College. I think it's called something else now. They represented a rather conservative angle of the disciples and of the Christian church, but they, like a lot of religious movements today, they're beginning to drift away from that themselves. In my research, I ran across this late. I found an article out of Bright College of the Bible at TCU by James M. Mowdy on the differences between the churches of Christ and the disciples. It caught my eye because James M. Mowdy was one of my professors when I was at TCU. And I remembered him well. I took courses under him. And I'm going to try and get that article. I'm going to write Bright College and try to get that and see what he had to say. It was written in 1943, I believe. The differences, and the reason I'm interested in it, the differences between the Christian church and the disciples in 1943 would be nothing like the differences today. And I just wonder how close, perhaps, he might have thought they were, or how far apart he might have thought they were.
Very interesting.
Well, we want to open now for a time of questions. And if you're a brother in the church, a male member of the Lord's church, and you're here tonight and you'd like to ask a question, we want to give you an opportunity to do that. We'll remember, of course, to keep all things decent and orderly. And so if you have a question, raise your hand, and Brother Eric Reiser will bring you the microphone. Please stand to acknowledge that you have the floor. Hold the microphone up closely as we are recording this session. Ask your question, and then we'll give Brother Ronnie an opportunity to answer it. So we'll now start taking questions. Oh, I know you have some. Brother Roger Boone.
I appreciated your talk very much, Ronnie. And I just want to ask, this was a peace slogan, the one you're working on. And you said it did not catch on amongst the followers of Stone. I'm not quoting you exactly, but... And let's see, the question was, the difference between Campbell and Stone was the reason that it didn't catch on amongst the followers of Stone because they had different emphasis in matters of restoration? And what was that difference?
I think primarily that was the case. As the movement progressed, once you begin to... you know, when you've got two movements and you've got a big man in one and a big man in the other one, and you've got a lot of people following each one of them, and then they combine, you always have the tendency of what follows that to still yield or feel toward the particular movement they came out of. They seem to have more dedication toward one or the other. I don't really know enough to tell you whether Campbell and Stone ever really worked out everything between them or not. They agreed on enough that they united, but I think there was always a more conservative approach by Stone and his followers than there was by Campbell and his followers, especially as the movement progressed. The disciples who came into power in the Campbell movement, especially after Campbell was gone, they took the movement in the wrong direction. There's no question about that. They became more and more liberal, and you know, you don't have to go very now. of course, Jaden McGarvey went to Bethany College, graduated from Bethany College, and then when he came back to Lexington, he started teaching in the College of the Bible there. And he remained, even though he made some foolish moves, I think, he remained pretty conservative, but a lot of the others did not, and they started very early in the opposite direction. I don't know how long the Stone people persisted in their opposition or how severe it became. I honestly can't tell you that. But I think there was a primary difference in their belief to start with about the scriptures and the applicability of the scriptures.
I just had an impression, and I have no idea where it came from, that you might know. That there was a basic difference in Campbell approached the idea of restoration from the goal of peace and unity in the first place, and Stone approached the idea of restoration with the goal, I'd have to figure out how to say this, but maybe the sanctification of the Christian from the world. The Christian's not supposed to be like the world. Would you say that was
yeah,
true?
I think that's accurate. I think another thing is, you know, when you quote Campbell, you got to know when you're quoting him, whether he was young, middle-aged, or old, because Campbell changed. He changed a lot over his lifetime. And he, for example, wrote against Sunday schools early and then later embraced them. He wrote against the Missionary Society, later became president of it. There are a lot of people who would tell you that, you know, when Campbell was in Europe when his little boy drowned, and a lot of people would tell you that he was never the same after that when he came home, and it affected him greatly. And one of my favorite stories, it's a sad story, but one of my favorite stories is after he came home one night, he woke up and his wife was gone. And they lived just right across the road from where the cemetery is at Bethany, where the little boy had been buried. And so Campbell knew where she was, and he went over, and there she was standing at his grave. And he put his hands on her shoulders, and he said, "They're not here," which was a profound statement because they weren't there. But anyway, they said after that that Campbell was never the same. He was diminished in his mental ability, and but Campbell changed, there's no doubt about that. In fact, all you've got to do is read the Christian Baptist and then read the Millennial Harbinger, and you can see a change in Campbell through the years.
I was just wondering, if our first goal is peace and unity, can we just, following the path of Campbell, presume we're going to change? There's going to be changes that, if our first goal... I believe we need to teach and preach peace and unity, but we also need to, you know, preach the truth. And
I agree. The only unity you can have is on doctrine. You've got to preach the truth and have unity on truth. If you don't, you don't have unity.
And we have to have the right doctrine concerning the peace and unity, and we have to talk that. One thing that happened in my life experience. I think there was a moment in time when I didn't talk love enough, and people thought I didn't believe in love. Nothing changed in me except I started talking love, and I started teaching biblical love, and that became an important, people viewed me differently, and I didn't change. I just started talking it from a Bible perspective. And the same thing I think is true of peace and unity. We need to talk peace and unity from a Bible perspective so that people don't get the wrong idea that we don't believe in peace and unity. I had another question. And you kind of answered this for me. But as we started off, I think, with in matters of doctrine, unity, and in matters of opinion, liberty. So, would this help us at all if we had a correct definition of the word doctrine and a correct definition of the word opinion, would that help us in being able to use that slogan, or is the slogan itself just flawed?
My honest opinion, I wouldn't deny that it wouldn't help us, but my honest opinion is the slogan is flawed. Because I think it started for the wrong reason. It always started in crisis situations. And there's always the tendency in a crisis situation to give up something you shouldn't give up in doctrine, and maybe move into the category of opinion, something that doesn't belong there, just to get along. I have to be honest with you, after I went through all this, my view of slogans is not very high. I think slogans, they sound good, and everybody says we do this and we do. Tell me a Church of Christ today, whether they have instrumental music or cups or classes or whatever they have, they'll all say, we speak where the Bible speaks and we're silent where the Bible is silent. I mean, that's their motto.
Thank you very much, brother. That was an excellent sermon. I hope I can express myself the right way in what I'm going to say, but as I've thought about this and as I listened to your sermon, I've thought about the fact that, the restorers were in a very different position than people who listened to the apostles preach in the first century. And in a sense, we are as well. The difference is that in the first century, these people were being presented with Christianity, not a certain kind of Christianity. There was just one kind of Christianity. The apostles proved themselves to be messengers of God and told them what the message was. And they either accepted it or they rejected it. The restorers were coming out of 1,000-plus years of religious error. And so I think sometimes those of us who have a historical connection to the Restoration Movement will look at the restorers and what they did. For instance, the fact that Barton Stone and some of those others didn't necessarily believe in the Trinity like we do, And some people will criticize it and say, You won't fellowship people who disagree with you on instrumental music, but you fellowship a man who doesn't agree with you on the Trinity. Look at you're majoring in minors and things like that. But it looks to me like, those men, they were interested in finding out what was true, and they had a lot of denominational baggage to work out of and work through over the years. And in their perspective, they had, in some way, a much bigger problem than just what to agree or disagree over. Their problem was how to arrive at what was true and escape what was error, what humans had added in. And what you described in the conversation that Thomas Campbell had with his audience, it indicates that Campbell made his statement not even fully realizing the implications that would have on his own doctrine and practice. And so, I don't know, maybe you can comment on this, but it seems to me that we today are living in such a different world in the first century. That's true. But the difference is we're living around so much religious error that claims to be Christian that we have to approach, first and foremost, finding out what is true before we get caught up in what do we have to agree on and things like that. I don't know.
I don't think there's any doubt. But what when Stone said, when he made the statement, if we select a group of things that we consider essential, and then later on through further study and acquired knowledge, we realized that was wrong. What will we do? Will we abandon what we said was essential then and put it over in the field of opinion? He was opposing this idea because of that very fact. I think he recognized the fact that he didn't know all the truth. He recognized the fact that it was a journey and that they were on that journey. I have the greatest of admiration for all of them. I really do. And I think they did a unique work, and I think God will judge them accordingly. I'm not sitting in judgment on Campbell or any of them. because they came from zero to a great recognition of what was right and did everything in their power to restore what was right, I believe, and did an admirable job of it. I think they were wrong about some things, and I think what happened is they got caught up in the problems that began to emerge, and consequently as a result of that they regressed somewhat. But the overall journey was a wonderful journey. But where you get to the point in the journey, where you get to the point where you start having this ultra liberal. Now, you know, you talk about really standing up and preaching. If Moses Lard were here, I'm telling you, he burned them up. Moses Lard was absolutely one of the most outspoken. He called a spade, and they all recognized that fact. You study Lard's speeches and his sermons. He left no doubt about what he thought about what was going on at that time, especially with the introduction of instrumental music and some of the other things. And so they had reached a point, many of them, where they would not tolerate this lollygagging around and embracing some of those things that were wrong. They really wouldn't do it. And it was a great journey.
Just one thing I'll say real quick. I guess that's why I agree with you. I have utmost respect for those men. I love to read after them and study them. But I guess that's why the pattern for true Christianity is not them. It's what happens in the New Testament.
Brother, you brought up the idea of lists tonight, and in fact, some of our own brethren are asking others of our own brethren for their lists. They want to know what's your list of things that we have to agree about to be in fellowship. And some of our own, and certainly this is a very popular idea in other restoration groups like the Christian Church, look to Ephesians 4:4-6 as the Bible's list. They'll say, well, I don't have a list. I'll just use this as my list, and those seven ones that Paul lists there. What's going on in Ephesians 4? And is that a list? Is that accurate to say that Paul gives a list of things we have to agree about to have unity?
Well, I think Paul definitely gives, whether you call it a list or not, he gives a group of items right there upon which our faith is built. Period. One Lord, one faith. You know, there cannot be two lords, there cannot be two gods, there cannot be two faiths. And I do believe that he lays down some very broad and yet very close principles that upon which union can be based, unity can be based. It's the unity, you know, when he says endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace, I think literally translated that's endeavoring to keep the unity into which the Spirit leads us. The Spirit leads us through the Word. And so it's the Spirit of God through the Word of God that leads us into unity by revelation. And so whatever is revealed in the Scripture is what leads us into unity.
So would you agree that Paul's not saying you need to believe in these seven things to have unity, but rather he's saying because these seven things exist, because the Christian system is based on ones, one God, one Lord, that's why we can even have unity.
Plus the fact you can't, in other words, you can't just say, okay, we all agree on those seven things, so we're united and we're not going to talk about anything we disagree on. I mean, you're laying the foundation for confusion when you do that.